Okay, so for a change, it will be not a very thoughtful talks. It will be just extraction from simulations. And so as it is, please prepare, it will be no analytics. It just be, will be extended zoo excursion. Yeah. Okay, so. Sorry. So just to start with, I explain what I'm doing, so it will be no comments after that, that it's not very complicated. Yes, it is not very complicated. And it's so-called population synthesis with dynamics, when you just take a two-zone cluster model and you do things for that, trying to put as good as possible the other physics, but not dynamics. The positive moment, we can easily do a few million stars simulations. Normally, the million star simulations only limited by the amount of memory you can get per node, and then you just limited by the rate with which these nodes communicate. So 2 million is currently the best solution when you just run multiple of simulations. And in general, what I will be talking later, it's results of 2 × 10^7 star simulations. Something like that.
Remind us, so a couple of million stars you can do on a workstation in how long?
Not on a workstation, but on a cluster. Normally, it runs from week to 2 weeks, depending on how many nodes I put. But for example, for 20 million stars, it's like a month. Like when I run at the same time several simulations. So 20 million stars, which is roughly a star mass of all global clusters in our Milky Way, is a month.
20 million stars, you really mean doing, repeating 10 times the same cluster with 2 million just to get better statistics?
Several realizations. So as it's very common, single stars are done with fairly good treatment of neutron stars formation. It's Kokolovs, we treat Higgs, electron capture supernova, binary stars as done with Bilchinsky code. And for triples, it's only dynamical formation using John's code for few body code, which gives out the hierarchically stable triples based on the Rosemary criterion, but from 2001, a previous one. So normally you start with relatively high binary fraction, from 50 to 100%. Standard assumptions about IMF, about the binaries distributions. And when I will say about the typical cluster, it will be this. There are also like 10 and 5 solar masses per cubic parsec, but also like 47 type cluster, and it's a bit different velocity dispersion, density, like 3rd-on-5 cluster. So those characteristics just will be taken directly from the Harris catalog when I will speak about the Harris type cluster or 47 type cluster.
It means you simulate 3-body and 4-body.
Yeah, few body encounters, yeah.
So, Natasha, when you say 100% binaries, in terms of dynamics, that would be 30% hard or something?
Yeah, so here's an explanation.
Oh, okay, thanks.
So, just to explain, when you start with 100% binaries, right, so this is a log mass for the primordial, for the primary mass, so the secondary will be in a flat mass ratio. This is a period, this is what we start with, and so here is the boundary between soft and hard binary, so everything here will be killed. So here is the density that will be killed through the stellar evolution. Right, so most of the massive cluster, massive stars will be killed through the stellar evolution, quite a plenty of intermediate mass stars. So what you actually left after your both collisions worked out and stellar evolution worked out, it's some region here, pretty small one. And actually what also I found that in order to survive, you actually should have like a hardness about 10, not 1. Most of binaries with hardness 1 will be killed. Through, they will get some more eccentricity, and they will eventually do the Roche-Lobe overflow, et cetera, et cetera. So you normally have something from the hardness 10 to here. This is your island of binaries.
What's the Bohr scale?
It's a density, distraction density, like a... This color is 100% of primordial binaries will be destroyed through stellar evolution. So less and less.
So why is Fred getting so stressed this morning about 1% binary fractions? Start with much less than 100%.
Yeah.
Eliminating things this way.
Well, yes, but if you start with all those binaries, you don't eliminate those. right? So yeah, so your stellar evolution will kill half, but the other half in the halo will stay. So if you, or you have to say that in global clusters, all primordial binaries will be relatively hard in some sense. So only stellar evolution can destroy, but we don't see the soft binaries. So soft binaries should survive in the halo. They are not destroyed by stellar evolution.
The claim in David's lab is really very strong. They are really talking about initial binary fractions of like 1%, not
10%.
Now, by taking into account the soft that they don't put in and so on and so forth, you might get from 1% to 3%, but not 30%. So it's still big.
You can put as many soft binaries as you like.
Not with reasonable distributions of periods.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If it's anything like constant in the log, as you said this morning, you know, flat top or anything like constant in the log, you cut all the soft, it's only a factor of two.
So you're bound by that 1% in this
in here.
Gene.
In here.
Although the softness is softer on the halo.
Yeah, this is the softness is for the core. In halo, there is no.
Here is that softness is a function of time. And Natasha, I think, will probably be the first to tell you that there's some disagreement between what she finds in her simulations for the evolution of the binary fraction and what other simulations.
Yeah.
So, Brad, you missed the discussion during the conference about this, but it was all basically about this. And there's basically just disagreement how the binary fraction evolves with time.
Yeah. But so now we go from the slippy matter to even more slippy matter. So triples formation. What we find from the scattering experiments is that a typical cluster, which will have 500,000 solar masses in my case at the current epoch, will form through its life 10,000 hierarchically stable triples. So it's a pretty good statistic. And if we will forget about the initial binary fraction, so then it's easier just to find the number of triples per number of binaries which are present in the core. So then you roughly find that the current epoch, or 10 giga years, it will be like a 5% of all binaries will become triple at some point. So this is a formation rate in the typical global cluster. And what else? Yeah, and the,
So this is formation from an isolated binary interaction, right? This says nothing about whether or not that triple's outer binary is hard enough to survive in the cluster?
No. It's just a formation of hierarchically stable triples. So the survival of those triples is the second question, okay?
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Then I understand.
So it's just how many triples can be formed. And
I should understand this as triples formed through
binary
fractions.
Yes.
So the number really goes like b squared, but you've normalized to n bin, so that's just proportional to
yes.
b, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You got it.
Okay, I heard you give the same explanation as before.
That's when you left.
Okay, so now just let's have a look a bit on properties of those triples which have been formed. So here I'm plotting the, this is accumulative mass of the inner binary, M1 plus M2, and this is M3. And in general, what's happening is that your M3 is a bit lower mass than the, at least the inner binary. Here, all the triples are shown with the dots, and the color represents the different epoch of formation. So obviously, like this tail is only early ages of the cluster, and then you go with the evolution, so you just shift here. So this is your region of triples formation at the current epoch.
Are those neutron stars or something? The greens at one solar mass?
Later on, okay?
Okay. But these are really the stars which were formed in this age range. And not which were present at this stage.
No, it's formation.
It's formation.
It's formation. The point is that we don't keep them, right? So once they formed hierarchically stable triples, we have to decide what to do with them. And normally we break them in some complicated ways. So here are periods. And so this is a density plot, probability density plot for the periods. This is the inner period. This is the outer period. And here on this color dots plots, I am showing the different type of binaries. And the dark magenta and dark red represents binaries with compact objects. And the dark red is when you have two compact objects. And compact object includes a white dwarf too, not only a neutron star. So obviously your period is shifting to this direction when you go to the binaries with one compact object or two compact objects.
To be clear, since I'm a little slow, this is formed at any time?
Yes, this is accumulated through all the time, not at the current.
This is deemed stable according to the properties immediately after formation?
This is hierarchically stable. It's not yet telling to you about how many of them will be destroyed immediately. It's just a formation.
In isolation state. It's
the stability of the isolated triple.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so it's stable at formation according to some version of
yes.
the modeling criterion without asking anything about later interaction.
Yes.
Or in terms of revolution.
Yes. Because you know those things can get complicated, and you. So you, we need to define the initial point at some point.
Stellar evolution is impossible, but you could actually keep in your simulations. You could easily keep the triples and do higher end interactions later on if you wanted to.
Yes, but will be it actually sensible?
Sensible. At least in high-density environments so, where the dynamical interactions may dominate over evolutionary-type problems.
But you can only keep the very hard ones. I mean, then you have to look which ones are hard.
Yes. So here is a distribution of eccentricities. This is a ratio of separations, and this is a outer eccentricity. So the outer eccentricity, as it can be expected, is a pretty thermal distribution. It's again the same distribution, but in colored dots for different type of binaries. They are not very much different. And then you speak about what's the distribution of hardness at the time of the formation. Then, so here is a hardness, and roughly half of them, a bit more than half of them, are actually soft. So directly after the formation, you may easily kill half of them just because of a softness criterion. Okay. So now we go to a bit more complicated subject, is that even if you kill all the soft binaries, so with the hard binaries, different things could happen. So, and one of them is a famous Kozai cycle, and the Kozai mechanism is the one which causes large variations in the eccentricity and inclination of a star's orbit, and especially if it's capped with tidal interactions, then it could lead inner binary to complete merger or Roche-Lop overflow. And if it's capped, then it's caused also as Kozai cycle with tidal friction. For those who want to get more details, I refer you to those two papers with a lot of details. But basically, in our simulation at least, we check whether the Kozai cycle or the cycle at which the inner eccentricity changes to its maximum value, whether it's comparable to the collision time of a triple. So if the Kozai cycle is smaller, then we do specific things to the triple, especially if the inner eccentricity became large enough to bring the star immediately to the Roche-Lop overflow, we set it as a compact binary. As a compact binary. And
sorry, you do what to the inner binary? If
we'll put it on the contact. If the Kozai, we make it contact. If
and circular as it.
Yes.
Okay, so you instantaneously turn it into a W or some majority star thing.
Whatever, yes. If it's a two-main sequence star, then it will be some majority.
And then, but then eventually.
Well, eventually something happened, right? When we do evolution with a binary star, with a binary code.
Okay, I'm a little slow again. But so you make it into a contact binary inside, and then you break up the triple.
Yes.
And then you follow the inner binary as if it's as you would normally.
Yes.
Okay. Because of course, and the question is, you know, how many of those would in fact have merged, right? At that moment.
Well, so if I will believe Peter Eggleton's stuff, almost all of them will go to this contact period And then when you're already on the contact period and circularized, then the outer triple already does very little to you. But you're already at the contact. So the question if you will merge or not merge depends more on the inner binary characteristics rather than the presence of the outer body.
In fact, wasn't there an argument already in Fabricio and Tremain that you would rarely get to a true contact system because of basically GR suppressing the Kozai cycles?
Fabricio's now arguing the opposite of the same.
They changed their mind on that, really?
No, they want to make all blue cycles
the Kozai. Oh, the Peretz and Fabricio paper argues the opposite, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, well, then pick whichever you like.
So just to go to numbers, if you speak about how many triples will be so-called Kozai triples, it will be a third of all triples. And this continues for any kind of triples if you look specifically on triples like with main sequence, or main sequence white dwarfs, like whatever population inside the triple, roughly a third of them, if you have enough statistics, will be Kozai triples. So here's just a comparison between the all triples with main sequence stars as inner companions, and here are Kozai triples with main sequence stars as companions, and those presumably could become as blue struggles. So what I can find from my simulation is that indeed there is a contribution from triples to form blue struggles, but it's at best 10% compared to all blue struggles formed through collisions or through normal binaries, and it's much less than Daniel Fabricio said, because he said it could be a major source for blue struggles.
Well, that was a major source in M67.
Okay.
Where you don't get any
other. Was this for 100% binary fraction?
Yes, but number of triples is directly connected to the number of binaries. So at least it's connected. So at least the number of blue struggle triples directly connected to the number of blue struggle from binaries. Okay, not to collisional, but to blue struggle binaries.
Sorry for one more question. Actually, could you say a few more words for this fraction of 1/3 being Kozai triples?
You know, actually, I think it's just from if your random distribution of inclinations is what you'll get with the body angle.
1 minus the cosine 46.
Yeah. 39. Blah blah blah. 39.6.
What you define as Kozai triple again is anything that is above the critical Kozai angle, or you need to be.
No, it's also, well, actually, here it's Kozai cycle plus collisional time. And
so it's anything that has Kozai cycles with a Kozai period less than the collision time.
Yes.
Independent of what maximum eccentricity actually
is. I think so, yes. So here, I think so.
Yes.
So it's a maximum estimate. Right, so here's just an example of a distribution of the same thing, but for binaries where at least one companion in inner binary is a compact star, like a white dwarf. So you basically just have a shift here. You have a lot of low mass white dwarfs in inner binary, so which tells you just that a lot of mass transferring white dwarfs binaries acquire during their evolution some outer body, which goes somewhere later, but it's pretty common for them to become a member of a hierarchical triple system. Maybe it's because the inner separation is pretty small, so it's very easy to have a hierarchy. Right, so here is just comparison of population in binaries and in inner binary of a triple at 10 gigayears. The only point which I want to make is that, so if you will compare, so here is the outer star in the triple. So if you will compare population of just binaries and the outer companions, the population will be the same. But if you look on the population of inner binary, then you'll see that it's well, at least a little bit less of main sequence, but the number of compact objects in a binary is bigger than in a normal binary population. So this is the only main difference which I found for triple population.
Can you test that with millisecond pulsars? I mean, I know there's one, at least one millisecond pulsar in double pulsars and triple. Any others? You still love binary.
I will go a bit exactly to this point. Not to millisecond pulsar, but to one extra binary.
I know one object that's down there in the 0.7%.
Yes. Yeah. But it's the number is not the main thing, but the characteristics of the system are more important.
By the way, but what you mean that now at 10 gigahertz, it's only the triples that will not have had a collision in that time?
Well, it's triples which have been formed within 1 gigahertz, around 10 gigahertz. So roughly like you take an average population, and those which are when will not have a collision, yes. So.
Okay, so it's recently formed triples.
Yes.
Because you might also have some formed much earlier on that are just in the halo and have stayed there.
Yes.
But that's not included.
No.
Okay. So I'm trying to take issue with your statement that it's just the characteristics and not the relative numbers that are important. And why aren't the relative numbers important? If you see one in the bottom right-hand corner, should you expect similar numbers of the others in the observations?
Well, the point is that, okay, so you see one, for example, millisecond pulsar in a triple, right? But when you look on characteristic of triples which you can form, and you find that you just cannot form this triple. So I'll go to this. Well, one thing is a number, right? So that you can form one triple with a neutron star. But another question is what's the period of this triple you can form? And what the periods which you observe? And they're completely different. Okay? This is an example.
Natasha, is the following a fair overview of the talk so far, just to make sure I understand the physics. Basically, that binaries through exchange interactions tend to get more massive things, which tend to be compact objects. And because triples are formed in binary, you tend to get compact objects in triples. Is that?
Yes, but also the point is that binaries with compact objects tend to be more compact.
Right, so you get fewer. Right.
And whenever you have a more compact binary at the beginning and you interact with a wide binary, your probability to form a hierarchically stable triple is bigger.
Right.
That's not strictly true, because when you exchange it with binaries, the compact object tends to be systematically heavier, and that actually makes the binary less compact. You widen the orbit of the binary, and then you have to re-harden it, which takes time.
If it's exchange, but it's normally not an exchange. It's normally you just grab one thing.
She's talking about a channel where you have a pre-existing compact binary that has the compact object, and it basically interacts as a single object with a wide binary and grabs compact.
Disrupting it.
Yes.
You
do almost nothing to this compact binary.
It's exchanging a compact binary into a wide pre-existing.
Natasha, I'm trying to understand these tables.
Mm-hmm.
Which of these percentages could I add to get to
Well, the there are some of them are mistakes, right? You should not add twice white dwarfs, okay?
So
white dwarf.
We just quoted twice, okay? I decided not to leave an empty square.
Don't you see the repeating patterns?
Oh, I saw that. It's
not that obvious, you know.
Across the island,
it adds up to more than 100%.
But white dwarf main sequence is
true. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter if it's white dwarf main sequence or main sequence white dwarf.
Oh, sure.
Okay, good. Shall we go?
Even with subtracting this main sequence white dwarf thing, it adds up to more than 100%.
Well, it's a bit, okay? So when I say 80%, I didn't add a dot point. I mean, come on, guys.
Okay, so that's a rough indication.
Yes. I normally give a first. You in astronomy, you should not take seriously the second digit.
Ooh, this is dense.
Okay, so here's just a short summary of whatever I said to you before, but it's not the end, okay? It's a summary about the, how many hierarchical tables you can form, that it's connected to the number of binaries you have, that you have at least half of them are short-lived soft triples, you break them easily. 75% of binaries will remain sequence-main-sequence binaries, and some of them will contribute to blue struggles formation, although not to extremely high numbers. And here are some characteristics of typical blue struggle and white dwarf main sequence binaries. The funny thing is that I found is that if you take out triples and you carry triples, then your number of cataclysmic fibrils will be reduced because triples actually effectively they kill some white dwarf main sequence binaries, which were CVs otherwise. Right, so this is some statistics, and we go away from the triple zoom to one possibly observed triple low mass extra binary. And before going to that, I just will say that formation rate for triples with neutron stars is about the same as for other triples, so it's 5% per giga per neutron star binary. So now I'm going to neutron star binaries. If you go to a high density like in Thurston 5, then the formation rate of triples with neutron stars is a bit high, just goes with the density. And again, the third of them will be quasi triples. So in this sense, they're pretty much the same. And now, what's the problem observation here? So there is an ultra-compact extra binary observed in NGC 6623. It has a very short orbital period, actually one of the shortest. The secondary star is presumably helium white dwarf with estimated mass 0.06 or 0.08 solar masses. It has very stable period, and the stability of period makes it certain that this period is actually orbital period. And this binary could be formed through just a standard scenario of which is a direct collision of a subgiant with a neutron star. The funny thing about this ultra-compact extra binary is that it has the luminosity variation by a factor of 2 at a superorbital period, which is 170 days. And the X-ray burst takes place only at the flux minimum, which means that the observed variability is due to intrinsic luminosity variations. It's not because of something else. Ratio between superorbital and orbital period is 22,000, and it's too high for any kind of disk precession at the mass ratio of the system. So it was suggested that maybe we see a hierarchical triple. And the first estimate done in 2001 was that the third body mass will be less than half a solar mass, but it was based only on the lack of optical detection, assuming that the ultra star will be a main sequence star. So if it's something else with a point half solar masses, that's not quite correct. It could be a white dwarf of unknown mass. And the third body orbital period with a simple estimate was found as 1.1 day. Recently, this system was reanalyzed by Snezhana, Pruden, and Norm Murray. They took into account much more of the effects. It's a perturbation from a third body in a longer period orbit, the quadrupole distortion of stars, tidal friction in a Peter Eglinton way, general relativity, mass transfer, gravitational radiation, whatever they could find. So they tried to do. They tried to do as good as possible. And what they find that they could satisfy the current condition of the system if they will start with having a primary neutron star 1.29, the white dwarf 0.07, the outer body is 0.5 solar mass. This is an inner eccentricity, so it basically tells you that it's pretty much circular. The outer eccentricity is also pretty much circular. This is important. So this is an inclination. It's just about the quasi limit. And the outer separation is actually 1.6 solar radii, which means it could not be a main sequence star. And so this model will reproduce very well the observed variation in eccentricity and the super period. What's the problem then? So the problem is that the outer eccentricity is almost zero. If you try to think back what kind of system could be in the beginning and will have now a zero eccentricity for the outer binary and will be formed within the Hubble time, then you could start with only this period distribution and eccentricity distribution for the outer companion. So it's pretty narrow parameter space for initial periods and eccentricities. And the point is that even with those values, almost from somewhere here to here, you could do eccentricity dumping only using the dynamical types for the outer binary. So it's also not very well developed theory, but the point is that you just couldn't do it through gravitational wave radiation. So it's pretty hard to circularize the outer binary.
Or convective?
I asked Bart. I think it was ready or something like that.
No, I'm not sure if it started. She doesn't know.
What do you calculate under what assumptions you calculate? Because exactly you don't know what's
going on. The
times are what?
The times are operating in what star?
In the white dwarf, outer, in the outer.
White dwarf.
Tides?
Dynamical tides.
So
that's why it's pretty tough. That's the problem. So if you have a, so basically this is the only period space, and even this period space is sort of arguable, which could bring your triple towards whatever exists now. So then you try to think if you can actually form any kind of this neutron star triple. So here I'm plotting the properties of all neutron star triples which I ever formed from all the simulations which I ever done, which is actually a lot. So here is a companion mass. So it's a I don't plot the mass of a neutron star because obviously it doesn't change much. It's
but I'm trying to do this with a again, a binary-binary interaction or some pure dynamical thing, but what about stellar evolution? What about the outer white dwarf being the what's the core of a red giant that gives you a common envelope type thing?
Fred, can you just wait a bit?
Oh, okay, sorry. So you first want to rule out dynamics to make it
interesting. That was the point.
Sorry,
you ruined that. Okay, so this is the inner period, this is the outer period, and you can, so this is a quasi-triples only, then the range of periods and the masses is a bit smaller. Okay, so eccentricities are not that important, but I will show one eccentricity distribution. So here is the distribution of eccentricities of neutron star triples, which I get from my simulations. This is the outer eccentricity. This is the inner binary eccentricity. And this is a the same results, but from Trenti et al. Simulations, 2008. And if the outer eccentricity is the same, and obviously they should be the same because it's a thermal distribution, but the inner binary distribution is totally different. And the reason, I think, is because we just took some approximation what will be your neutron star binary. And in fact, in my case, many of neutron star binaries being formed through a physical collision, so basically they do have zero eccentricity. They're short period.
So the Trenti stuff, that stuff that he just, that drops out of his simulations, right? And of course, those are more like open clusters where the density is much, much lower.
No, but the point is that they don't have physical collisions.
Oh, they must include them, they just don't occur.
No, I ask.
They don't include them.
No.
An N-body 4?
No, we don't include the neutron star binary formation for the red giant direct collisions. And this is the main reason to have here eccentricity zero.
That's circular.
Yeah. So that's the reason for the difference. Okay, so now you just again plot this arguable parameter space. You look on the parameter space for the all formed triples. And the arguable parameter space is here. So it's pretty unlikely to form a triple in this way.
Well, at least it's not black.
You see one, and this one is one of the lowest density parameter space. So where are all the others? So again, yeah, I think that dynamically we couldn't form directly this triple. And what we need to have is the outer common envelope.
Wait, an outer common envelope?
Yeah, you have the third, the outer companion will become a red giant.
It's such a short period thing. But then you would, shouldn't your outer period be really tiny after that?
Yes, it is 4 hours.
I know.
That's the problem. Yes?
Do you make a direct collision? You take an ultra compact pre-existing binary and smash it directly into red giant at the tip?
Yeah, maybe.
You've ruined another slide. Oops.
Well, I want to rescue dynamical interactions.
You two should not sit close to one another.
Wouldn't you get it easily when you have an encounter of one of the triples with another binary, or maybe a single star?
The circularness of the orbit.
The problem is to get it circular.
It's all of your nice scenarios.
Well, we do not have to answer Stan's question, since we've done this with Jamie. You do not get these kinds of very low eccentricities out of collision with red giants.
No, but this is a collision with a binary.
It's an 11-minute binary. It's an 11-minute binary on this compared to the size of a giant.
It's an 11-minute binary now.
So what you exactly had, you had two giants coming together at the same time, and the neutrons start passing by, and then they get triple body formation, which was exactly...
I remind you all that we're being recorded.
Okay, I'm done.
Big brother.
Triples to the zoo of triples to the triple. So I'll be quick. It's a nice thing about globular clusters. There are absolutely no binaries in them, but we know for sure there are some triples. Good. All right. There are just about enough young people around here that we are morally obliged to discuss the system. Those of you who were here in 2003 can go to sleep now. But this is M4. And we're not done yet. Most of this talk is based on a conversation that happened at that table over there over a very nice bottle of a local red.
When?
2003. Oh. Last global cluster meeting, of course. Yeah. All right, so there's M4. I'm way overloaded on pretty pictures on this, by the way. But, you have them, you got to use them.
It's the end of the day. It's the end of the day.
Exactly. So M4, just to remind you, it's a nice medium-sized globular cluster. It's not one of these 10 to the 5 per cubic parsec things. It's close. Moderately low metallicity. My usual caveat that we should always remember of globular clusters that half the mass of the globular cluster is outside the half mass radius. They do not consist of the core. And as we now know, it's 12.7 billion years old. M4 had the second discovered millisecond pulsar in a globular cluster. It is a bright millisecond pulsar, 11 milliseconds, very easily discovered. And it is a binary pulsar. It has a helium white dwarf companion. It is a descendant of a apparently classical LMXB. So Rockport and Podsiadlowski did the modeling, yeah. But a 1AU orbit, 191 day orbital period. The pulsar is not in the core of the cluster. It is projected to be maybe at about 2 core radii. And it has been studied to death, with the exception of the breakdown of major radio telescopes, which is happening with deplorable frequency. If it hadn't been for the Green Bank rail cracking about a year and a half ago, we'd finish this by now. But we had to wait for more data. Okay. So we finally observationally beat this thing to death in 2003 when, after about the third glass of red wine, we realized that it was actually in one of Harvey's fields in M4. So we had extremely deep Hubble imaging. And we could see it. It's probably a hair over 0.3 solar mass white dwarf. So if you remember Lars's talk, a RGB descendant of the Turnof mass star, where you strip the envelope. And that fits in perfectly with it having been spun up through Roche-Loeb overflow, very nice mass transfer system. The white dwarf has a cooling age of 500 mega years, if you believe Brad's models, you better. And it has a dynamical age, I claim, of less than 2 giga years. That is to say, statistically speaking, it should return to the core, and the time scale for the return to the core is order 2 giga years of dynamical friction. It is not favored to be positioned in its current position. It's a massive system, at least 1.7 solar masses. As a conjecture, I would say the most likely scenario for the formation of the pulsar white dwarf binary is that it was originally a neutron star white dwarf binary with something like a 0.7 solar mass white dwarf in something like a 20-day orbit, eccentric orbit, so descendant and intermediate mass X-ray binary, and that it exchanged the Turnof mass star of roughly 0.85 or 0.9 solar masses into an eccentric 40-50 day orbit, ejecting the high mass white dwarf, leaving a neutron star main sequence companion that got ejected out of the core due to dynamical recoil, going out to a little bit further than the half mass radius, where it'll loiter for about 2 giga years. Angular momentum relaxation is faster than energy relaxation, so the orbit first somewhat circularizes. With radial out of the core, the pericenter is kicked out, get partial circularization, and then things start drifting back in again with random walking. Okay, so if this is a correct picture, and that is not necessarily true, the system was in the core 10 giga, after 10 giga years after it formed, and then spent the last 1 or 2 giga years out of the core. Like so.
Oh.
So just a scattering plot.
You're like
scaring them. It's nothing. You should have seen this one before. I've shown you at least 3 or 4 times.
Well, I haven't been here, and I always like to scare
them. So this is the sort of scattering that could have happened. Original system comes in from the bottom. System meets it, comes in from the top. New system goes to the left. Something gets thrown off to the right. Ew, I had far too much time playing around this. It was pointed out in 87 that if there are planets around pulsars, you can detect them for timing. So all you got to do is to find some pulsars, which we do in globulars. Of course, you're better off doing millisecond pulsars than regular pulsars. So if you have planets, you ought to see them. How would you get planets? You might make them 1257 style. You could make them through supernova fallback. You could make them through disruption of a companion. You could make them through some sort of unstable mass transfer with an excretion disk. Or you could steal them. And all of these are possible in globular clusters, although planets made from supernova fallback are tricky because they have to stick around for a very long time, although they might still be relevant. So,
wait, Stein, I'm sorry, you went through that quickly. Did you mention the Davis scenario where you shock a disk and get fragmentation of the planet?
No.
Well, you can fragment a disk. How you do the fragmentation, I don't care.
Well, that's what Melvin says. He says you just get lucky, and you have some other thing whiz by. You get a close interaction. That sure. perturbs the disk. And sure. You get fragmentation.
Sure. And depending on the disk, you may not need to do that. You may just...
And the disk is around 10 billion years because...
Yeah, well. Anyway, I will tell you why that does not work for this. Basically, almost all the disk fragmentation or late disk formation scenarios cannot work for the system, probably, unless Fred thinks of something in the next 10 minutes. Okay. So, if there are planets in globular clusters hanging around the stars, if they're bound to stars, then the neutron stars, being probably the more massive objects in the current era, tend to do most of the interesting interactions per unit star. So to the extent that planets are going to be hopping around, they have a disproportional probability of ending up around the millisecond pulsar, if the millisecond pulsars are there, which they are, and if the planets are there, which they may be not. Well, the 3 years after its detection, Steve Thorsett noted in his thesis that there was a peculiar timing residual to pulsar 1620-26 after you fit the full relativistic orbit for the white dwarf. And he left it at that. Don Backer noted at the 92 meeting that the residual was consistent with it being a triple, and that the range of solutions ranged from Jupiter mass planet to 100 solar mass black hole. And at the same meeting, I noted that if you were a pulsar and you were to acquire a planet through an exchange, it would tend to be the Jovian mass planet, and it would tend to end up in orbits consistent with the lower end of the range of solutions for 1620-26. There then followed approximately a decade of basically theorists throwing papers at each other while the observers waited patiently. But the solution space for the system shrank steadily. The system has now both crossed the plane of the sky and crossed Apastron. So we don't have a full orbit for the outer object, but we do have a change in sign of the period derivative and a change in sign of the second period derivative, if I remember the geometry correctly. It turned out there was an enormous confusion at one point because the observer's phase convention on the orbit was the opposite to that of the theorists. I think we've got that sorted out now. But
crash a satellite into a planet.
That's right. 180 degrees off, that's no problem. So the current solution is that it is a Jovian mass planet. It has to have a mass greater than 1.3 Jupiters, probably about 1.8 Jupiters, and certainly less than 3 Jupiters. There used to be a lot of degeneracies in the solution because of the various crossing points in the orbit that are aligned along the line of sight. You've got projection singularities. Those are all gone away now because you've crossed all the planes of the orbit. So the orbit is a low eccentricity orbit. It's approximately 0.1 to 0.15. It is high inclination, and it is a stable circumbinary orbit. It almost certainly formed through exchange, because it is very, very difficult to form it in situ with a high relative inclination to the inner binary. And it is essentially impossible to excite the inclination without also exciting the eccentricity. In fact, in all models, the eccentricity is a little bit worrying. Well, I think I have a way around that. You can place the planet there either early on with the current white dwarf's progenitor, or you can pick it up later. Yeah. But either way, the planet appears to have come along with a ride from a main sequence star, probably a turn off main sequence star, although if you pick it up later, you have more leeway in picking it up from an end dwarf or something. And to be in the present orbit, it had to have started off in a near circular orbit, probably, most likely near circular orbit, with a orbital same age axis between 3 and 8 AU. Just the energetics when you go backwards. To be in the current orbit, it has to have been, I think, probably 3 to 5, but you could probably go out to 8 AU if you go to the tail of the allowed energy exchange. The white dwarf has an eccentric orbit, 0.025, which is anomalously high for something that used to be in contact and did mass transfer. In a series of papers the Fred and co-authors did, they looked at this, this was COSI. There is a marginal solution space for COSI exciting this eccentricity for either a orbital parameters of the planet that are basically resonant to the GR precession, or for somewhat counter-rotating initially planets. The somewhat counter-rotating solution is probably ruled out now, but it depends on how far it evolved from counter-rotating to pro-rotating during evolution, a dynamic evolution of the system. If it is in fact in GR precession resonance, that is a curious coincidence. Not impossible, but might indicate some little bit extra physics. So the clues we have are the age of the system. The white dwarf is relatively young. It came off the main sequence relatively recently. And the fact that the system is not in the core. The whole thing is unstable once it goes back to the core. That planet's not going to stick around for another 2 giga years. It's going to be stripped off by perturbations from the other stars as it gets back to the core, or even possibly a little bit earlier. I don't actually care anymore if it exchanged at the same time or if it exchanged afterwards. I think it's more elegant to do the exchange simultaneously and just do a single exchange and park it out in a halo orbit for as long as possible. But you can do it later if you want. I don't care.
You're hoping that by wearing a suit I will make this more elegant?
No, I have achieved Zen. It's like, yeah, whatever. You know. The key points are the elements of exchange and that. What could be better? depends on how you handle the prior probabilities, and it depends on whether stars and globular clusters actually have Jovians around them, which actually motivated us to go and look for them. And well, the hot Jovians are not there, which is translated into a general myth in the community that because there are no hot Jovians, there can be no planets.
Yes, ridiculous.
Yes, yes. So we're being recorded, so we'll stop right there. you know, it's very typical. You measure a very narrow corner of parameter space and you extrapolate uniformly across all parameters. Just like the theorists or something. All right, so here's a pretty picture of how you do this.
To be fair, it's not that simple, Tom. So, I mean, you have your hot Jupiters, right? But then you don't go too far before, from dynamics, you start destroying them.
Well, no. This is where the point that half the stars are outside the half-mass radius comes in. You really don't mix your average 0.6 OMS star at 2.3 half-mass radii into the core a lot.
That's true. Yeah. And the statement applies to the core, definitely, but not to
that. Yeah, but even in the core, the 1 week, you know, 1 to 2 week orbital periods stick around for a long time in most clusters. I mean, not an M15 or 47 tuck, but the mass in the core is tiny. So.
Well, there's an easy way to tell. You can do a simple thought experiment. Take the distribution of known planets, put them in the global cluster, what fractions are there?
Right. So you do that, and you scale for metallicity, for formation efficiency, and we should have found 4 or 5 hot Jupiters if everything scaled. So hot Jupiters are under present. At arguably several sigma.
And that's even at the half mass radius.
That is, yes, that is in the outer parts of the cluster.
The
well, no, the metallicity, metallicity doesn't work because we did it in 47 Tuck, which is pretty metal rich. I mean, there are stars in the field that are more metal poor than 47 Tuck that have hot Jupiters. And we have there's no way. When you see the plots of number of planets versus metallicity, they always stop at a metallicity of minus 0.5. That's because they don't want to show the points that are further to the left. Because it kind of ruins the curve. Anyway, my favorite wild speculation, provided there are no hot Jupiters, is photo evaporation of disks. If you photo evaporate the outer disks fast enough, which you should do very efficiently in clusters because they're full of O stars, you get a hard edge on the proton disks, and that changes the reflection of the spiral density waves due to Jovians in the disk, and you can actually reverse the sign of the torque and stop, not just stop migration, but reverse it. You can't, if you do try to do it dynamically, you just regrow the disk and you get a fuzzy edge again. But if you photo evaporate it, you keep a sharp edge and you move it inwards, and that actually changes the angle momentum transports on the disk.
Oh, so that would evidently work in high metallicity things like Thursium 5.
It would or would not?
It would, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And in Thursium 5, so you can do the dynamics and you might predict, well, people have predicted, mostly me, that there's a planet around pulsar there, but Scott Ratson didn't see any.
Right, but now we have seen another one. But not in Thursium 5. Thursium 5 timing is kind of crappy so far. These things are hard to see, and Thursium 5 they're really having a hard time.
Well, I asked him specifically, you know, for Jupiter at I don't know how many AU, and he said it was clear that it wasn't. But that was for some limit.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, it's got to be for some limiting orbital period. Yeah. Okay.
What observations are there for hot Jupiters and global eclipses?
There was a big transit search. There have been big transit searches.
Oh yeah. Oh.
I was part of a HST transit search in '99. Where we looked for a week and saw nothing, and then, yeah. And since then, there have been ground-based follow-ups. See, that explains it all. Even convinces John. It's on the web. It's M4. See, there's a star. It goes into the core. When it's in the core, it's a binary. The binary meets another star. Actually, that was a star with a planet, and there's the binary. Binary meets a star with a planet, captures the star, takes the planet with it, throws away the other star. Ta-da! High inclination binary with a certain binary planet. And then it becomes a red giant. Whoosh!
Product of press releases, in my opinion.
This is a product of a press release.
So, you actually did look at what this does to the outer eccentricity, right?
Yeah. Well, there is a conference paper where I flap my hands very hard. So during the red giant phase, the inner binary circularizes, its orbit expands, and it loses mass. And I checked this. The orbit expands first, and then it loses mass, right? Most of the mass loss at the tip of the RGB. This is very important. Somebody please tell me I'm right. If you do that and you look at the if you look at the red giant parameters, the current the current planet orbit is in marginal tidal contact with where the red giant would have been at the tip of its evolution. It's very hard to calculate because it's not actually a spherical red giant.
Quite. If the mass loss is important, then there are some uncertainties in this case because it's virtual red.
Yeah.
And what if most of the mass is actually accreted by neutrons? Does that change something?
Yeah, except that the neutron star didn't spin up very much. It's only 11 milliseconds. So I think we had fairly late contact and didn't transfer very much mass on the neutron star. We will know it soon, though. We're getting relativistic parameters. It's consistent with like the canonical 1.35 solar masses or something. So when the red giant was at its most extended, just before you finish the envelope, when you're in the current final orbit, the if the planet had been any more eccentric than it is now, it would have been in strong tidal contact with the red giant. So its current eccentricity is marginal tidal contact, which suggests that it might have been a little bit more eccentric in the past and circularized a little bit. But it couldn't have circularized that much. It would have been just, you know, got into tidal contact for like one e-folding in eccentricity.
You never said, maybe because it's a little disturbing, but what would typically have been the orbital radius of that Jupiter when it was still in its original system?
3 to 8 AU. So it had to have been in the halo of the globular cluster for most of its life. So it had to have been a turnoff mass star that was below the average mass of the cluster for a long time. And it came in from outside the Hofmann's radius sometime in the last 2 or 3 years into the core, where it met the neutron star that was already in the core.
And the best estimate of the current outer A is what?
14 AU.
14 AU.
Yeah, which is why it's going to be unstable when it gets into the core.
And you expand mainly from the mass loss?
Yeah. So it went from being a 2.2 solar mass system to being 1.7 solar mass system. And you went from 5 AU to 10 AU during the exchange, roughly. Where are we in time? Okay, we're fine in time. So if you were in marginal tidal contact, now, why is this an issue? I'm backstep a little bit. The current eccentricity is right at the lower end of the range that's plausible, given what happens during exchanges. You tend to have typically high eccentricities during exchanges. If you had a very high eccentricity, then the planet would be dynamically unstable. You kind of put a planet out there with an eccentricity of 0.9 because it becomes unstable, and we just saw that. So the allowed ranges of eccentricity are sort of 0.3 to 0.7. Probability of getting an eccentricity of only 0.1 is 1% or less. And then you're starting to pile up a lot of very improbable numbers, particularly given that this is the second and best studied millisecond pulsar around. Second discovered globular cluster millisecond pulsar. I mean, this thing's really been looked at very, very hard for 20 years. However, if it used to have an eccentricity of 0.35 or 0.5, the periastron used to be a little bit closer. During the red giant phase, it was in tidal contact. It circularized a little bit by about a factor of 2 or 3, so one e-folding in eccentricity. And then the red giant went away. The envelope collapsed, it decoupled. Time scales sort of match. This is tidal coupling, so there are fudge factors of a few, and it's not a spherically symmetric system, so you have to look at some sort of rotationally averaged teardrop, which is impossible, so you just make up a number. However, this could also, in principle, lock you into a GR resonance. So this could be why the COSA mechanism worked also. You didn't drop the eccentricity inclination during this, you only dropped the eccentricity. And then you also drift the system into GER cosi resonance, which allows you to pump the eccentricity of the inner white dwarf up. If anybody's feeling particularly inspired and wants to calculate this explicitly, please do. Because saying it is easy, demonstrating it explicitly is not easy. So this leaves two possibilities. Either this is a freakishly weird and lucky system, not the one of the brightest millisecond pulsars in the globular cluster, the second discovered, the one we happen to have the best timing for, is interesting and has a planet, or planets are, they're coming. And then you get to, no, why haven't you seen them already? I should also notice that a general property of these systems, the planetary system of globular clusters, is you expect them to be metastable in the sense that if you see them, you expect to see them where their lifetime to disruption is of order their lifetime. I make that assertion in anticipation of the next pulsar planetary system, whose parameter I happen to know. For the record, and I may not tell you anything more than that, there are unmodeled, very small, but extremely statistically significant residuals in the current pulsar timing data.
Scott Hansen talk about?
No. Scott does not have this data, I think. Well, he sits in the pipeline, so maybe he does. Funny that. I got very excited earlier because I decided this must actually have been the ultimate. Brad and I have this contest to come up with the ultimate title for a paper. And
Heraclius was involved too.
Oh yeah, we're not there yet, but we're getting there. You know, maybe it wasn't the main sequence turnoff star. Maybe it was a blue straggler. The reason I'm very excited about that is HR 8799, which is three planets, and is a metal poor A star in the galactic neighborhood, which is also a weird in a couple of ways. It's a Lambda Boo and Gamma Draconis. So depending on which cycle of the fashion you're in, suggests that it may be a blue straggler rather than a recently formed metal poor star in the galactic neighborhood. The three planets. So clearly, when main sequence stars merge, they have excretion disks in which planets form. Geo-wind mass planets at large radii. Of course they do. However, I was just about to rush over and write a paper about this when I realized that this completely trashes the mass transfer of this whole system. And you don't make a nice circular helium core white dwarf binary because you have a star that's now more massive than the neutron star transferring onto. But we're not done yet. Of course, you don't have
to.
It doesn't have to be more massive. Exactly. Well, it could have been. I thought, you know, blue star was 1.7 solar masses. That's bad.
That's not.
No.
2 masses.
But 1.2 solar masses.
Yeah.
That would work.
1.7, yeah. You could still keep it there.
And then you don't have this perfect circularization during the giant phase either. If you're close to mass ratio of unity, you start getting these tidal excitations in the giant envelope. So I think maybe.
The average mass of the cluster
is 1.5. OK, so 1.2 solar mass blue straggler star that made the planet late recently. Might even got infrared luminous, you could see it. Maybe you don't even have to worry about the white dwarf eccentricity anymore. Maybe you can get rid of the whole cosi thing by just having it not be a low mass X-ray binary, but a near equal mass X-ray binary. But it could still be a paper. Nature seems to really like blue stragglers this week, so, you know, got to get in there real fast now before they get bored and start doing radio observations or something.
What will be the title? You know, you said you wanted.
I haven't talked to Brad yet. But, you know, pulsars, X-ray binaries, relativity, blue straggler planets, Hubble.
Nice Chinese.
With Chandra observations, too. It's like, we can do everything.
And speak about this other millisecond pulsar that have planets.
I did not. You are right. That is because there is a Green Bank Canadian ninja squad ready to assassinate me if I mention any any word of the properties of that system. But Scott did tell you its name.
Do you know anything?
No. Well, I know it has planets. But
if
that England has you so scared, she doesn't seem that
either. You were there. No, Ingrid wasn't there when we had that bottle of red wine. See, she was the only author on the paper who was not at the table. That's because she owns the data. I'm not crossing Ingrid, I'm sorry. But if you look at our videos, Scott did in fact flash up the ID. It is NGC 6440C, a very nice little millisecond pulsar. And if you can do Fourier transforms by eye, the residual curve is there. And it is interesting. I've seen the zeroth order solution, and it's a fascinating system. Yeah, okay. So, after a very long time, I think we mostly understand the key issues of 16, 20, minus 26. I think it really has to be a planet. I think we're not completely and utterly nailed down where it came from, but we understand many of the key features. And really, from the perspective of a cosmologist, we're quibbling about details. I'm intensely interested in the implications for planets in low-metallistic systems, but we need more data on that before I think anybody will let me do any theory on that. And we should see more of them, since we saw one in the first two systems and a second one in the next 100 systems. But remember, the later systems are fainter, and the timing is sparser and poorer. Except now Greenbank is now cleaning it up, but to the extent they're allowed to do follow-up and get good cadence on following up known pulsars. You really need to go back to these things over and over again with big telescopes and get high-precision timing, get phase-connected solutions over many years, and get microsecond residuals. When you do, the planets have to pop out. Can't be a unique system. This is now one in the field and two in the clusters. Okay.
If I put my Fred hat on for a second, you have to work so hard to explain the one triple system that we know. I mean, how am I then supposed to believe all these published synthesis of triples?
It's a long gamma ray burst problem. No. It's a long gamma ray burst problem. You have millions of channels happening, and you only need to find the one in a 10,000 that gets you the right system. And I actually found this channel before.
You have the same predictive power as the gamma ray burst is.
I'll take that.
Not the afterglow people, the actual gamma ray
burst. Well, they know the essential features of the system now. They're at high redshift, and they have something to do with black holes. No, I actually, one thing to remember is we have extraordinary data on this system because we have 16 significant figure timing over a 20-year baseline. And we have a phase-connected solution that's wrapping around to a complete orbit with like 8 post-Newtonian orbital parameters. We see the torque of the plane of the binary. We see the tipping of the plane of the binary due to the planet twisting it. We're going to get an independent estimate of the period derivative of the pulsar because we can disentangle the period derivative of the binary orbit from the timing. The timing age, by the way, is 500 million years, roughly. But all of these things have to fit at the same time. So yeah, they actually, most scenarios people come up with you can destroy.
So what you're saying is, if you had less information, it would be easier to explain.
Yeah, I mean, in 10 years ago, there were lots of explanations for the system. And as more and more data came in, more and more explanations got destroyed. And really, there are two variants of the same scenario, I think, that still explain.
If you're really interested in the history of this, it used to be a lot harder. Because, of course, we used to think that this millisecond pulsar, like all the others, was very old. So if the inner binary was very old, but the lifetime, the angular lifetime of the outer orbit was very short, it was really hard to make this. Okay. That's when we all wrote some pretty crazy papers. But now that they showed so nicely that the inner system is young, the white dwarf age is clearly very young, it's not a problem anymore if you get this very easily. Even more easily than the standards.
And we should have known because it's bright.
Which model do you like most, having many planets all in the globular cluster and just this capture scenario?
I like that.
That would be nice if you had lots of planets.
I think POP2 formed planets and that migration was inhibited.
Speaking of lots of planets, has anybody thought of lots of free-floating planets?
Yeah. During the M22 fiasco, there was an enormous number of even crazier papers about that.
Sure, I know those, but in this context, I mean, how would you get this playing any dynamical scenario you want, but the planet was not originally attached to a star, it was just free floating.
That's almost impossible. Usual.
Nothing's usual.
Okay. Okay. And if you make it a binary planet, it's a piece of cake.
Free floating in the globular cluster, you mean?
Yeah. And there are no limits.
This guy's going to become a free floating planet. You want to make this triple by pushing.
If you put more than about 10 million planets in there, you start having problems. That was one of the problems with M22, is the mass in planets were so enormous that it actually distorted the cluster profile and started making collisions.
We have a lot of free-floating planets.
About 10 to the 7. After that, you'd start wondering why you're not seeing splashes on the stars and stuff.
So you can't take this free-floating planets, huh?
Not that I've thought of. But, you know, now that you challenged us, we can... Yeah, cut yourself.
There is a paper, unpublished, thankfully.
I mean, there were papers that Nevermind wanted to capture it from a free-floating planet. They wanted to capture it from a galactic field star during this crossing.
Scott Gardy wrote a paper about producing hot Jupiters by tidally capturing free-floating Jupiters onto and attaching them to.
I would much rather write a paper about tidally disrupting free-floating Jupiters and globular clusters than intermediate mass black holes. Okay, gravitational wave signatures from tidal disruptions of hot, free-floating hot Jupiters by intermediate mass black holes.
That's good.
Cool.
In the scenario where you start with a blue straggler, would you have more metals than this Z is 120th?
Yeah, because you'd...
Metals?
Well, it depends on when and where you make the blue straggler, right? Because if you make one of the stars late enough,
why would you get more metals?
Well, if it's a McCrae, or it was a McCrae type 1 mass transfer blue straggler, and you've gone into shell burning and you've made CNO.
But is CNO enough to make a planet?
Yeah, you just need cooling. You don't care about iron. You just want something that radiatively cools the disk.
Okay, so it's phase.
So it's a diamond planet.
Then maybe.
Well, if I'm allowed to choose my stage of nuclear evolution and where I mix things. I mean, if you really want a lot of metals, you go to Mario scenario of using a COY dwarf. But then you have to get the planet out there.
Yes.
And that's very hard, yeah.
And then the planet is also CO?
Yeah. So pure carbon planets are a hot thing.
This was one of the models for making the Waltz and Pelsen.
Yeah. So planet formation during accretion-induced collapse. If that doesn't explode the heads of some of our colleagues.
Tidal disruption of a neutron star with strange matter in the center. Really helps coagulation if stuff just sticks.
So you're saying it's a strange planet? Because if I remember correctly, freely escaping strange matter can have a stable low mass matter. Yes, okay.
I'll make a note to the person sending up the web video that they should cut the last 10 minutes.
The only way we can get the particle theory is to watch these things, talk about strange matter in the last 5 minutes. Yeah. Or, you know, if you really want to go wild, have a double neutron star merger with a lot of R process ejection happening.
Yeah.
So this is like ruthenium planet. All right.